Welcome to the PHA-TDH Weekly COVID-19 Conference Call. My name is Jenny. I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star then 1 on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Wendy Long. Dr. Long, you may begin.
Hey. Well, good morning, everyone. We appreciate you joining the call this morning. It has clearly been a very, very eventful week. Without further ado, I think I will go ahead and turn it over to Amelia Keaton in the Department of Health. As always, our goal for this call is for it to be interactive. And so after the Department of Health makes their sort of opening comments and provides any information they have, we encourage you to use the star 1 feature and let us know what kind of questions you have, or just give us insight into how things are going out there on the ground. So with that, Dr. Keaton.
Hi, this is Amelia Keaton with the Healthcare-Associated Infection Program at PDH. I'm joined by Dr. Tim Jones, our Chief Medical Officer, and Julie Schaffner, our Deputy Incident Command Leader for the COVID-19 response. So we're going to try to keep our updates fairly short today. I think there are likely lots of questions out there that we want to have time to answer. As of this morning, we have a total of 154 confirmed cases in Tennessee. As I'm sure most of you are aware, a lot of labs have come online since we last spoke and are performing testing outside of the state public health lab, which I think is a great service. With that, we obviously are seeing more cases than we had seen before. We are trying to update those daily on our website. It should be pretty easy to find, but it's the Tennessee Department of Health CDEP COVID-19 website. It should be the first thing that pops up when you Google COVID-19 in Tennessee. So we're updating those case counts daily at 2 p.m. We're also trying to break them down by county just to provide a little bit of additional information, as well as the ages for the patients that we have that information for, knowing that in particularly with specimens that were tested at commercial labs, we may not have full epi data or epidemiologic data available for those patients, but we're trying to get that as quickly as possible. In terms of other updates in Tennessee, we are also doing our best to collect COVID-19 assessment sites, which are places that patients may go to obtain testing. Those are broken down by county. And again, we are still asking that if you feel like you may require testing for COVID-19, to please call your healthcare provider first, see if they are able to do the testing. If they are not able to or are not able to see you in a quick fashion, please check our website. We have tried to list these testing sites by county. With regards to other news, we are trying our best as soon as we receive lab results for COVID-19 testing to get those out both to the provider and the physician or other provider who may have collected the test, as well as the facility. It may be a bit of a lag before we have an official laboratory report for those items, and so we are asking if you are waiting on those results to take action at your facility, whether from a contact tracing or other infection prevention and control standpoint. We promise that the results that we send you are accurate, even if they are not in the official laboratory report that you're used to seeing, and so we would ask that you try to accept those and not delay doing what you need to do for another official lab report. Another thing that we are trying to recommend folks do is that if you are performing testing through the state public health lab at the time of the initial call with us, please let us know who in your facility needs to receive those results once they come back, whether it's representatives of your infection prevention and control staff or your lab, just because that will make things easier on our end distributing the results.
Needs to be one. Sorry, Tim Jones, just to I think add to that. Am I wrong?
We've been providing results to everybody that requests it at the time of ordering, because there's lots of issues where patients are starting in an outpatient facility
okay.
and end up admitted.
Okay. Sorry.
So,
never mind.
Yeah, no, the only reason we ask that is just because we know there's a lot of parties that need
it. As long as we have the capacity to do it, that's great.
Yeah, so when we do the initial consult, we get the email of the provider, and then we also will ask if there's an infection prevention and control person that we need to put on that email, as well as any lab contact. So it should be not a heavy lift on either side, but again, you know, this is rapidly evolving and our guidance may change. I think a few other resources that we want to point you to, so we know infection prevention and control issues are a major concern with this pandemic. My team, which is the Healthcare Associated Infections Program at the Tennessee Department of Health, has a dedicated inbox for this, and we are trying to work to ramp up our capacity to check this most hours during the day. The address for that is in, I think a lot of you may be aware, but if you're not, the email address is hai.health@tn.gov. You will be routed to one of our infection preventionists. We have 5 on staff who will do their best to return either the email or to call you in person to kind of work through your issues. If you're calling the clinical consult line, those people may not be able to assist you, and so I think it might be more efficient for everyone to try to use that inbox you know, to the degree possible. Overnight, and again, we're making sure that we regularly check that email inbox from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. There may be somebody who is able to check it intermittently after that, but if it is truly an emergency and you need help more quickly, we would ask that you contact the on-call after-hours phone. But, you know, as CDC and other sites ramp up their resources for infection prevention and control, we're finding that a lot of questions can be answered there as well. So just something to think about when you're working through those issues. With regards to personal protective equipment, we know that those are, every component of that is becoming short across the country, and Tennessee is no exception. We are trying to monitor those supplies in our healthcare resource tracking system for our long-term care providers. So we're looking at things like gloves, masks, gowns, N95s, and are asking the facilities make sure that they have a person who is entering that data and updating it daily. That assists us in knowing where there are potential shortages or shortages that are happening in the future. We know that this is not a resource that long-term care facilities or outpatient facilities have access to, and so we are trying to work on solutions for that as well, but those might be a bit longer in coming. CDC has developed a long list of recommendations for folks in preserving PPE. I think initially the concern was that there would be a shortage of N95 masks, and while we have certainly seen that, there's also been shortages in other components, which include the gowns, the gloves, and surgical masks. And so they have a wide variety of strategies to help preserve those, and I encourage every facility, even if you're not experiencing a shortage right now, to look at those resources ahead of time and have plans in place that you can use, you know, in the event that those do become in short supply. That is all I have from a healthcare-associated infection standpoint. I am looking at Julie Schaffner to see if she has anything else she'd like to share at this point.
Nothing at this point. Dr. Jones?
So, yeah, I am going to. Hi, this is Tim Jones. So I guess just to stress a couple of the things that Dr. Keaton said, right now people are calling us desperate for equipment and supplies. You know, it's you will get a very frustrating answer. We just don't have any. Now we hope to very soon get access to limited supplies. We will get that information out to high priority facilities and areas as soon as we can, and we're already working with THA to let them know our mechanism for that. It's very likely, at least at the beginning, to have that distribution of any supplies that we have go through the healthcare coalitions, and those, you know, every single hospital in the state is part of a healthcare coalition. There are 8 across the state. If you don't know what I'm talking about, please, as soon as this call is over, go talk to the emergency preparedness folks or other staff in your hospital to find out who it is and get them to explain it to you. Because this is a group that was essentially set up precisely for this, to work on and to meet regularly and to have plans for cooperation amongst institutions, and that includes triage of equipment, making decisions about, you know, how institutions share things, and in the past, this has included things like decontamination sites, you know, not having them everywhere, who can do it, there are discussions about the vents and all that kind of thing. So please ensure that your institutions are prepared to participate actively in healthcare coalition meetings and discussions. And probably it'll be important that folks at a high level know about that. Thanks. If and when supplies become available, and we're talking about when it's limited, not just when a market's flooded, facilities really must follow the CDC's recently published guidelines about conservation of equipment and supplies that they already have. Now, if a facility wants to, you know, continue doing hip and knee surgery or plastic surgery and things like that that would be considered voluntary for economic or other purposes, that's perfectly fine. It's a decision on the part of your institution, but it also is sort of a determination on the part of your institution that you have enough supplies to be able to do that, plus handle expected COVID activities and things like that without additional supplies from elsewhere. So please just make those plans and decisions very thoughtfully. And the other thing is that as we're using the hospital network and healthcare coalitions in these sort of supply distribution decisions, there will not be additional or separate supplies for remote assessment facilities. You know, people are calling drive-throughs or set aside, you know, the tents and the things you have out in your parking lots. That everything that we get will be through the hospitals, and so you all will need to make decisions about how much of that gets shared with or assigned to any of these other activities under your purview. So these assessment facilities and things like that. And then the last thing I'll mention very soon, if it hasn't happened already, THA is going to be sending out a copy of the Crisis Standards of Care. Again, you and your institutions should be very familiar with those. They were developed with TDH and THA several years ago. These are sort of models and were intended to be used as a baseline for then institution-specific plans. So please dust those off. Talk to your, you know, I would say up to the highest level in your organizations, because when these decisions get made, they're going to be institution-wide and very, very dramatic. There are states that have already started applying some of these principles for making decisions, particularly in terms of use of supplies, which is the situation that we're in right now. You know, I don't know of anywhere across the country that's having to decide, you know, who goes on a vent and who doesn't. But each institution needs to at least be very, very familiar with what your institution's procedures will be for handling those kind of decisions if they have to be made. So that'll include your ER, your ethics folks, if you have a board, administration, and all of that kind of thing. So I'm sorry, I'll stop there, and if any of you want to correct me, that's fine.
No, I think that actually brought up a few other points that I forgot to make earlier. So I think one thing that some of you may have heard about and some of you may have not is that CMS has released multiple documents in the past several weeks regarding response to COVID-19. I think one that they released most recently is really encouraging facilities to look at telemedicine and telehealth models as a way to help ease the burden on healthcare facilities. I think they've tried to provide specific guidance on how to approach that and also how to perform billing and receive reimbursement for those services. Even if your facility has not engaged in something like this in the past, it might be something to consider, and it might be a way to help alleviate the burden on your providers and other healthcare workers. And again, that's through the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. Another issue that we are finding ourselves increasingly notified about are healthcare facilities that have healthcare workers who are testing positive or who were exposed, remain asymptomatic, obtain testing, and then test positive. And so I think those are becoming increasingly complex. We totally understand that, you know, that it's putting everyone in difficult situations. We are trying to work on guidance on how best to approach those. CDC does have guidance specifically for what to do with exposed healthcare workers. What we have not seen from them is what to do for patients who are potentially exposed to confirmed healthcare workers. And so we are working on that, and we recognize that that is a very challenging situation for everybody involved. And then another point, I know that there are some folks representing long-term care facilities here. We have been very fortunate that we don't have any known confirmed cases of COVID-19 in long-term care facilities. But with that said, we are asking you to please notify us if you have any clusters of respiratory illness. That should be a standard practice related to influenza, but I think it's more important than ever in, you know, the setting of COVID-19. And the definition of, you know, what a cluster is, I think, has been up for some debate, but typically we say that it's two or more residents who develop respiratory illnesses within close proximity of time, so within a matter of a few days. You know, I think we know that nursing homes are a very different setting. They're set up to be different than acute care hospitals. They don't have the same resources as acute care hospitals. But with that said, you know, for patients particularly with mild illness, they can be cared for safely in nursing homes. It's just a matter of making sure that you take the right infection prevention and control precautions, and the ACAI team is happy to assist with that. I know I've tried to distribute some of the resources CDC has developed specific to long-term care facilities. We are also happy to give more tailored, detailed guidance if that's something that your facility would be interested in. And again, I think just in it remains as important as ever to stay informed about this. We're updating our website with the Tennessee Department of Health every day. We have a lot of documents specific to the state of Tennessee. You know, we're having these weekly calls. We're trying to increase our capacity to do calls for other groups, particularly long-term care facilities. But just let us know how we can best get material out to you all and the needs that you're seeing on your end.
And now Dr. Keaton has reminded me of a couple of things.
Sorry. Dr. Ron, I promise you will have time for
that. We haven't hit that. Yeah, I apologize. I think in terms of, and you've heard me say this before, but in terms of the last thing, one of the things Dr. Keaton mentioned, one of the hardest groups for us to connect with is community providers and primary care providers, and that's just because there are 18,000 of them in the state. We're doing our best. We're having conference calls to which all licensed primary care providers are being invited, but it's difficult to get those folks on the line. And, you know, hospitals and your institutions probably have very good communication networks. Many of you run primary care sites. You have a whole bunch of physicians and providers that have privileges at your center, so we would really encourage you also to help spread some of these most important messages out to them. And then I wanted to talk about lab access, or testing access. The all of you are, I assume, experiencing difficulty sometimes even with private labs accepting your COVID testing your COVID test. If you look on the FDA website, as of last night, there's a very long list of all of the laboratories that are now accepting specimens, and it's a lot more than, you know, Quest and LabCorp and the state. So, you know, if you're, I think we've heard that LabCorp and Quest and some of those, you know, AEL, you know, one day you'll call and say, will you take our test? And they'll say yes. And 6 hours later, they won't because they're being overwhelmed. So I would encourage your labs and institutions to kind of look at that other list and see if you might be able to take advantage of them. And then also on the same FDA site, a day or two, I think yesterday, they have loosened up the criteria for specimen collection. So they're saying that now you can use saline instead of viral media. There's a rather long list of swabs with the commercial numbers. And, you know, if you haven't been able to get swabs from your usual supplier, you might try those other companies. So now don't, I would say call the laboratory that you're using to ask if that specific laboratory will accept specimens under these new guidelines, but given the shortages, I expect they will be soon. Now I will shut up. You guys can go.
All right, I think we're ready for questions on our side.
Operator?
Thank you. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touchtone phone. And we do have a question from Lisa Castillo.
Yes. Could you address how you're going to allocate your excess supplies or your extra stock of supplies when you ask us to delay our elective surgical cases and those of us who do and those of us who don't? Will you consider that in the allocation of these supplies?
So, again, good question. The decision about whether to conserve and all that kind of thing is use the preservation guidelines completely an institutional decision. But if for the supplies that the state has access to, yes, you'll have to have adhered to those for the reasons that I talked about before. Ultimately, though, the decisions, these kind of allocation decisions, will be made within the healthcare coalition that I talked about. So make sure you know who those folks are and be prepared for those discussions. And those are the groups that we'll talk about, you know, whether it's population numbers, bed numbers, however they want to do it. So it'll have to be a mutual decision, and the allocations will have to go through hospitals and not, you know, private practice groups, other kinds of facilities. And as much as we, you know, completely appreciate the need that there are many, many other high-risk groups out there, it's simply the only practical way for us to do it. So if there are outside providers that want to work with their hospitals to figure that out perfectly well.
And once again, that's star then one for questions. We have one more question.
My name is Juanita.
from a person? Yeah, go ahead.
My name is Juanita Holland from Memphis, Tennessee. I work at the mental institution here. And my question has to do with the recommended attire, PPE, for the healthcare worker that is screening visitors and employees as they come in the door. I'm concerned about, is there a recommended attire as far as gloves, wearing a mask, things of that nature?
Yeah, great question. So what I will say is that we are asking all facilities to post signage, you know, for anybody entering the building. If it, you know, or if you are doing triage and assessment, that sign should say that if you have respiratory symptoms, put a mask on. That, I think, is probably the most important aspect of any of this. If you are able to do those triage or those initial intake things at a distance, that's also extremely important. I don't know if having staff members just wear PPE for any kind of triage or assessment is a good resource for you know, personal protective equipment. And we actually have some guidance on our website that helps walk through kind of the PPE to wear by exact situation. But we would consider things like triage and intake to be low-risk activities, especially if you're able to provide distance between yourself and the person.
Yeah, I would think long and hard and talk about that within your institution, because you can burn up a whole lot of these very badly needed supplies doing that.
Yeah, that's what my concern is, because we were asked to wear a mask. I am the IP at my facility, let me preface with that. And we were asked to wear a mask while we were doing the screenings for visitors to come in. And then in addition to that, they made mention of wearing masks for the healthcare workers once they're in the facility when they are assessing the patients. And I'm just concerned about us burning through our supplies that we have on hand.
Yeah, so there's a couple of points I would make there. I think one is that you should limit visitors if at all possible. I think that's one way to help minimize the risk of, you know, of infection. We know that is, you know, a hardship for anybody that has to do it, but these are really, really unusual times that we're dealing with. So I would also think long and hard about restricting visitor access first. Second, I think if an employee is a known exposure to a person with COVID-19 or, they have any kind of symptoms of illness themselves, I would not recommend a blanket recommendation that they wear PPE when doing assessments of any patient. I think that kind of, as you've mentioned, that is a way to use a lot of PPE where it may not be necessary. That also brings up another point, in that we are receiving calls from facilities who find out, I think, several days after the fact that an employee has gone to obtain COVID-19 testing, whether they have symptoms or if they're asymptomatic. We are asking facilities to really consider telling their employees that if they pursue testing, if they think they have had an exposure, to please let their employers know ahead of time so that they can take appropriate action, whatever that may be, for their specific facility. But I think it really creates a difficult situation when an employee who's been seeing patients is waiting on a test result and does not notify anybody of that.
Along those lines, anyone who goes and gets tested must be quarantined until the test result comes back. By getting the test, you're identifying yourself as a person at risk of having COVID.
Absolutely.
So that automatically buys you quarantine until a negative test comes back. So someone can't be coming back to work or anything else like that until they then are negative.
Sorry, I know that was a long answer to your question, but does that sound reasonable on your end?
It really does. I really had issues with, someone was saying, well, why don't you have a mask on? Why don't you have a mask on? And I'm thinking, the most recent recommendations was for the person that is actually doing the triage to not wear the mask. And
yep,
if someone comes into the door and they're coughing, or they tell me I've screened them from a distance and they tell me, yes, I've been running a fever, then yes, we'll probably put a mask on them. We're doing temporal scans to begin with. But I'm just really concerned about the overuse, because I know the difficulty that we're having in getting the PPEs to begin with.
Yeah, we are concerned. We share that concern with you, but I think it sounds like you're doing everything appropriately on your end to try to limit that use.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you for your
response.
All right.
And once again, that's star then one for any questions.
Dr. Keaton, it's Chris Clark at the Tennessee Hospital Association. A couple of questions that have come up from people close, primarily infection preventionists and nursing leadership, is the department or is CDC going to create training materials specific to the new guidance on how to safely reuse N95s, how to repurpose an eye shield correctly, and that type of thing, reminders that contacts and eyeglasses are not the same as a shield for the eyes, those kinds of instructions that are a little bit more specific that could be one-pagers like your other guidance documents you have available. Is that something you've considered already?
So I think that CDC has released some guidance, some pretty wordy guidance with those tips. I think we could definitely look at making those a little bit more streamlined out there. I know some other state health departments have also tried to put things together for facilities, because we know that it's definitely not intuitive and not something that is commonly done. But that's actually a really good suggestion, and we can look at that on our end.
I think that would be well received and appreciated, and also give staff some reassurance that we haven't flipped guidance on them and putting them at greater risk.
Yep, exactly. Good point.
Thank you.
And we do have a question from Marisa Moyers.
Good morning. My question is, when the president spoke last night about releasing the manufacturing of the N95 mask for the commercial industries that were not approved prior, will this free up, and do we need to get those companies in our system and start trying to order from them for the N95 and some of the gowns and jumpsuits that they have, or will that be distributed through our healthcare coalitions or sent through our healthcare coalitions as well?
So I think the details on that are still to be determined. What I can say is that in some of the kind of crisis situation guidance for things like N95 masks, it does suggest looking at standards other than what are typically used for N95s. I don't know if that even includes those sort of non-medical supplies and looking into those, but I think we probably need a little bit more guidance before we can make a good recommendation on whether those are appropriate or not.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Joe Landsman.
Yes, I'm here with Joe Lanson. It's Keith Gray, UT Medical Center, Knoxville. I just want to just go back and clarify two questions ago about protecting our team members who are actually screening at our access points. The question is, don't they need protective PPE if they are screening? Specifically, do they need to have to wear a mask?
So, sorry, when you say access points, are you talking about these COVID-specific assessment sites?
No, just the entrance points into our facilities where visitors may be entering the facility and being screened.
We are not recommending that at this time. We are asking that facilities look into engineering things, so, making sure that they can perform assessments from a distance greater than 6 feet. Making sure that there's clear signage for people coming into the facility to put on a mask if they think that they have COVID-19 or may have been exposed to it. But I think we are not recommending that people wear masks who are just doing those initial intake and assessment evaluations.
All right. Thanks for the clarity.
Huh?
And we do have another question from a person that did not leave their name. If you could state your name and your question, please.
It's Amy Reimer from Methodist Medical Center. And I have a question. We are looking for direction on visitors coming into our facility that have traveled to high-risk areas or have had previous exposures coming to the hospital for end-of-life situations or hospice or palliative care decisions. Should they just be masked or determined for symptoms? Any guidance?
Yeah, so that's a really tough situation. I think probably the clearest guidance we have on that sort of thing would be for nursing homes and long-term care facilities that are dealing with hospice patients or patients that are at end of life. I would try to encourage, limiting visitors, if at all possible, to immediate family and very close friends. If they must come in, I would look at, putting them in appropriate PPE. Hopefully there are not that many of those folks who are traveling back from high-risk areas at this point. I know travel has been significantly curbed in the past couple of weeks, but I think I would probably consider doing PPE for those who absolutely must visit the facility.
Okay, and we are encouraging phone communication as much as possible or FaceTime even, but
yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You.
No, I think that's a very reasonable question, I think.
Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. And we have a question from Lancaster.
Yes, I'm in Collierville, Tennessee, and I read conflicting and hear conflicting information about how long a room needs to be closed or unoccupied prior to placing another patient in the room, and was just seeking clarification. I'm seeing anywhere from an hour and 45 minutes to, on one of the other calls, 45 minutes, and was just seeking clarification, recommendation on that.
Yep, so that will depend in part or in large part on the number of air exchanges that happen in that room per hour. So we know that in a typical negative pressure or AIIR room, it's usually 12 air exchanges per hour. Other rooms in healthcare facilities vary significantly. There's a really nice chart on CDC that kind of details the clearance time or the expected clearance time by the number of air exchanges. I think the piece of information that we don't have is how long the virus that causes COVID-19 survives in the environment, but I think just a general rule of thumb is that the longer the room is vacant, the better. I think based on review of that chart on my end, I think probably the longest time would be 2 hours for clearance of all particles, but again, the more air exchanges per hour, the faster it'll clear, if that makes sense.
So that 2 hours, is that based for a room that's getting 12 changes an hour or six?
No, so that would be less than six. So I believe six, if there's six air exchanges per hour, it would range from 35 to 45 minutes, depending on what you're looking at.
Thank you.
We're trying to pull that information up right now just to give you an exact number.
That's, I'd heard for 35 to 40 minutes on the other call the other day, but then there's some charts that are being circulated where that length of time is much, much greater than the 30 to 45 minutes for a room that's got 12 air changes an hour. So I was just trying to seek clarification. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's good. So the 35 to 45 minutes is based on a regular hospital room that's 12 air exchanges per hour. I think for ones that have fewer, it will be a longer period of time.
Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. And we do have a question from Dan Sanderson.
I think that was Jim Vanderzeeg. This is Dr. Mark Brown in here with Jim. Just some clarity that I've gotten from our infection control, infectious disease physicians around the air exchange issue and that chart that's being floated around through the CDC guidance. That chart is designed, according to my infectious disease and engineering folks, for perfect air exchanges. So when you see an hour turnaround for normal six air exchanges, that assumes no mixing factor at all. In other words, nothing is sitting in front of an intake vent or the bed isn't blocking some of the airflow. And so we are working with a mixing factor that we've worked in for if you don't have more than, if you have only six air exchanges like a lot of hospital rooms are, he's really recommending 2 hours. What we're looking at doing is any place where we're putting patients who are being tested or patients who are positive to ramp it up to 10 or 12 air exchanges an hour, hopefully shooting for 10, so that those rooms can be cleaned and turned over in an hour. It's around 48, 49 minutes. So that's the guidance we got from our folks, because you can't take those numbers on that table assume a perfect mixing factor of 1. And so you're probably not getting enough air exchanges in most hospital rooms today. Hopefully that's helpful.
Yep, we completely agree. I think that table represents the best guidance we have at this point, though, understanding there are a lot of other factors that go into the clearance of infectious particles. I think if your facility has the capability to do those sorts of adjustments, we are all for it. But we are trying to base, you know, our evidence on what we know in best case scenarios, and then also encourage, you know, if you have the ability to wait longer to place patients in there or have patients go in there, you know, that obviously will be safer. But what we're hearing from facilities is that in, you know, these high volume periods, it's just not always possible to go significantly longer. So, but that actually is very helpful to know that your facility has the ability to do that.
And that's star then one for questions. We have no further questions at this time.
Well, this is Wendy. We really thank Tim and Amelia and Julie for being with us today. And we will reconvene, I believe, next Friday, same time. And thankful for all the work that all of you all are doing out in your communities. I think we'll close the call.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.